seeing that this month marks a decade since the Bush administration launched an attack on Afghanistan in response to the events of 9/11, what it labeled Operation Enduring Freedom. I thought it was appropriate to have as a guest one of the most important critics of that war and someone who knows the ways of the battlefield firsthand. His name is Andrew Bacevich, and he is currently the Director of Undergraduate Studies and Professor of International Relations and History at Boston University. And if his name is familiar, you've heard him before on my program as well as on Democracy Now! A West Point graduate, where he later taught, and a career Army officer who served in Vietnam and retired as a colonel, Professor Bacevich slowly awakened to the truth about the reality of which he had been a part after retiring from the service. He then began writing books and articles in the hopes of turning the country that he had loyally served from the path of enduring war. His first appearance on Takes on the World came after the publication of his first book, The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War, in 2005, and he has since produced four more books dealing with the American empire and its imperial ambitions and its limits. Professor Bacevich's latest book, Washington Rules, America's Path to Perpetual War, published in 2010, represents an important continuation of his investigation into the mindset that has encapsulated our ruling circles since we emerged victorious after World War II. Washington Rules, America's Path to Perpetual War, is a book that every concerned citizen needs to read in order to fully understand the direction this country has taken since the end of that war, regardless of who has sat in the White House as Commander-in-Chief, be he Democrat or Republican. It's a book that should be in the hands of every high school and college student whose history textbooks have served largely to glorify America's military exploits and set the table for more to come. Welcome, once again, Professor Andrew Bacevich, who takes on the world.
Well, thanks very much for having me on your program.
It's good to have you back, and it's good to have a voice like yours out there telling the truth. We've just completed the first decade of our war in Afghanistan, since extended to Pakistan, and there are no credible signs that it will end any time soon, President Obama's promises notwithstanding, since, as we have learned, they're worth very little. Now, the American public is being geared up for an attack on Iran after an Iranian-American with alleged ties to some higher-up in Iran's Quds Force has been caught up in an incredible plot to assassinate the Saudi ambassador in Washington, as well, if necessary, innocent Americans, including perhaps members of Congress, who are not so innocent. And old reliable Joe Biden tells us no options are off the table. After reading Washington Rules, I guess none of this comes as a surprise to you, except perhaps the clumsiness of the alleged Iranian plot.
Well, yes, although I'm probably not as concerned about an attack on Iran as your remarks suggest. There certainly are people beating the war drums, but I think they tend to be neoconservatives or the reflexively hawkish members of the United States Senate, and those folks don't necessarily have a lot of clout and credibility at the moment. My guess, and it's only a guess, would be that the military itself will not be especially keen to start another war. The military, a decade into this mess, certainly has its hands full. So getting the generals and admirals to go along with an attack on Iran at this juncture, I think, would be pretty difficult. They'll do what they're told to do at the end of the day, but they'll be asked their opinion about a war before it begins, and my guess is that their opinions are going to be negative about opening up an Iranian front to go along with all the other fronts.
Well, it's been my take since at the beginning of the Iraq War, the same neocons who orchestrated and pushed for the war in Iraq have been doing so for Iran, and it's been only the Pentagon, in fact, that has kept that from happening. But there's also the possibility that there's been talk in Israel about Israel attacking Iran, and that would, of course, sooner or later involve the United States. What do you think possibly of that might be?
I think that's a much higher likelihood. Again, I don't pretend to have any inside information about decisions in the Israeli government, but Israelis in the face of what they perceive to be a threat, are inclined to shoot first and get around to asking permission later. We have the attack on the Iraqi nuclear reactor 2 decades ago as a precedent in many respects. The 1967 war is a precedent, or more recently, the incursion into Gaza, Operation Cast Lead. The Israelis probably have, if not capability sufficient to eliminate the Iranian program, certainly they could do great damage to it. And I think your comment is right, that were the Israelis to attack Iran, the perception would be, whether accurate or not, the perception would be that we had given them the green light, and so in one way or another, we probably would be dragged into whatever occurred in the wake of such an attack.
And, of course, certainly they'd have the support of members of Congress.
One could anticipate that a vast majority of both parties in Congress would cheer for Israel, as they reflexively do.
Well, it's interesting, and going through your book is very depressing. A number of my programs tend to be depressing, but it's very important for people to understand that what we're seeing in Afghanistan, what we saw in Iraq, what we see in Pakistan, and now with AFRICOM in Africa, this is a continuation with apparent but not real breaks from a policy that existed in the United States since the end of World War II. Perhaps you could elaborate on that.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I cling to is my conviction that if you really want to know the big truths about U.S. policy, you don't look for differences between Republicans and Democrats. You look for the continuities. And I think that when it comes to national security policy, the continuities between the days of Harry Truman and the days of Barack Obama are massive. And in particular, I think that the defining themes of U.S. national security policy reduce to what I call in the book a sacred trinity, namely that we design our forces not to defend the country, but to provide instruments of power projection, that we then establish, maintain a global military presence, and that we, with considerable frequency, marry those power projection capabilities and that global presence together to support policies of global interventionism. That's what we do. That is the essence of the national security tradition that's existed since the end of World War II, and it continues to exist today. I mean, it is astonishing, really, that President Obama, who advertised himself as an agent of fundamental change, it's astonishing the extent to which he has embraced that sacred trinity and made it his own. You just alluded a second ago to the introduction of a small number of U.S. forces into sub-Saharan Africa, and I think that we don't know where that escapade is going to lead us, but I think that's emblematic of this sacred trinity now being applied in what could well be a brand new theater of operations.
Well, this whole notion that America is the global policeman, with all these, the whole world being broken down into various commands, the latest being AFRICOM, is something that is accepted without question by members of Congress and by and large the American public. It's as if the American public has been immunized or inoculated into thinking in a deep sense, as you have done, about U.S. military policy.
Well, I think, I mean, a second ago you said that sometimes you have shows on that express a certain level of discouragement. I think what tends to discourage me is how little we as a people are able to learn from our experiences. I mean, it is astonishing that the United States, our fellow citizens, practical purposes, flushed the Iraq War down the memory hole already. It's not even over, and it's already forgotten. There's been remarkably little effort to extract lessons from that experience, to understand why we went to war, to understand why the war went so badly. It's just something that we wish to set aside, flush down the drain. And that penchant, that absence of consciousness on our part is one of the things that discourages me.
Well, having been a history teacher myself and occasionally substituting at local high school, during when the Iraq War began, the school was told the teachers not to discuss the Iraq War. And although it was teachers who responded to questions, but this was a general policy in the textbooks, for example. The average American student growing up reading American history textbooks that the authors try to sell in 50 states end up knowing very little. And by the way the courses are taught, the Vietnam War has virtually disappeared unless it was a member of your family who served in it. And again, with Iraq, given the fact that there was no draft, and again, unless you're a member, have a friend or a member of your family serving in Iraq or Afghanistan, there are no thoughts by the general public of what's going on over there unless they think about some money being spent, but they don't think very much about that. This seems to be maybe perhaps one of the goals that President Nixon had when he eliminated the draft back in 1971.
I don't think so. I think it's really an unintended consequence, although as a consequence it's turned out to be of enormous significance. I think Nixon ended the draft mostly because he was trying to buy time for his Vietnamization program, and he thought that one way to buy time would be to basically disarm the anti-war movement, and he calculated that ending the draft would do that. And
he was right.
He was exactly right. But I think that the distance between the American military and American society, the unwillingness, therefore, on the part of the average American to calculate the true cost of these wars, the tendency to defer to people in Washington on national security, I think although the ending of the draft is an important marker along the way to where we've become, I don't think that was Nixon's intent. I do think that more recently, policymakers, I think this was very true in the George W. Bush administration, have exploited the fact that the military has become detached from society. They've exploited that fact in promoting policies that they wanted to promote. They anticipated that the American people would have a short attention span or limited interest in the wars that they began. So they were quite shrewd, I think, in taking advantage of this fact.
Well, certainly the average American, if they could find Afghanistan, or let alone Pakistan, on the map, have really no idea what's going on over there. And unfortunately, they don't care much about it. And the argument that are made in the halls of Congress of why we should remain in Afghanistan is if the Taliban or the Haqqani network is some threat to Americans and American soil, this is never discussed.
It's sort of it's stated but then not demonstrated. There's another puzzle. It is true that the 9/11 attacks were planned in Afghanistan. It's not true that the 9/11 attacks were launched from Afghanistan or that the attackers were Afghans. They were, for the most part, Saudis. And so that the notion that somehow we need to pacify it, that it were we to pacify Afghanistan, that the so-called terrorist threat would go away, doesn't pass the laugh test. Al-Qaeda is a threat, albeit not an existential one, But Al-Qaeda does not require Afghanistan to serve as a sanctuary. And what's more troubling still is, it seems pretty clear, that the effort to pacify Afghanistan has the unintended consequence of destabilizing Pakistan. And the fact of the matter is, the fate of Pakistan is of far greater importance, orders of magnitude greater importance to us than is the fate of Afghanistan. So we're actually creating a very large problem in our effort to fix a problem that we have overblown.
And this is one of the contributions that President Obama has made, because actually he did keep two promises. One was to expand the war in Afghanistan and also to expand the war in Pakistan. And I think you might say a large responsibility for the destabilization of Pakistan falls at his doorstep.
Oh, I think there's no question about that. I mean, there's absolutely no question about that. And given the fact that President Obama is, I think, clearly a very smart guy, in many respects a very shrewd guy, quite frankly, the magnitude of his errors in that regard just seems surprising. I myself don't understand how a guy who is, I think, as smart as he is, would have gone down the path, again, specifically with regard to what we're doing in Pakistan, which strikes me as, just set aside all moral considerations, set aside legal considerations, just focus on whether what we're doing is smart or stupid. And I think it's pretty clearly stupid.
Well, one thing you point out is that Obama, like every president, seems to be given a set of options that are limited. But in this case, it seems like he stretched out this one further than he had to. And we have to see the end of the consequences of that, because obviously the U.S.-Pakistan relationship is not a healthy one. And this is a very large country, significant country. Should that come apart with nuclear weapons, we have another major problem. One of the things I want to get into the book, which I found very interesting and very important, is you, going back now to the days of Jack Kennedy, you demystify a myth that has grown up around Kennedy, that had he not been assassinated, he would have pulled the troops out of Vietnam. And as you go through his and Bobby Kennedy's history, beginning with the Bay of Pigs, or following the Bay of Pigs with attempts to assassinate Fidel Castro, then with the beginning of the war in Vietnam, you make a strong argument that Kennedy was in no way a dove, and that he was in no way going to step out of this continuity and become a peacenik. And perhaps you could elaborate on that.
Well, I mean, the Vietnam question is one in which it's pretty contentious. There is evidence that he had indicated some desire to begin to reduce the U.S. presence were he to be reelected for a second term in 1964. Now, even to the extent that that's true, you have to scratch your head and say, what kind of president is it who would continue to have American advisors in harm's way for a policy that he didn't believe in, that he was going to liquidate as soon as he won a second term? But that said, the evidence that he would pull out is certainly not conclusive. I mean, let's face it, one can never know what would have happened had he lived. But I think more damning, really, is the evidence of his recklessness with regard to other issues, and in particular, his recklessness with regard to Fidel Castro and the threat posed by him. It wasn't a threat, but the problem of Cuba. Kennedy supporters like to argue that the Bay of Pigs was a wake-up call, that this catastrophe engineered by the CIA and signed off by the military, had alerted him to the dangers of simply going along with hawkish advisors. I think that that argument doesn't stand up to any kind of scrutiny, given the fact that as soon as the Bay of Pigs was over, he launched Operation Mongoose and put his brother, the Attorney General, in charge of it. Operation Mongoose being a very comprehensive campaign intended to do whatever was necessary, all kinds of dirty tricks, to eliminate Castro and overthrow the communist regime. That's not the behavior of a prudent, clear-thinking chief executive.
Well, it certainly, you go into the details. I think it's really important. One of the things we haven't gotten into, but you talk about the development of the CIA under Alan Dulles and the Strategic Air Command under General Curtis LeMay, who I remember from those days of Vietnam War. He was going to threaten to bomb Vietnam back to the Stone Age, and the power that they both assumed in their respective agencies. SAC bombers were 24 hours in the air with nuclear weapons. Most Americans don't even remember those days, but they set a tone in which they actually had more power, in a sense, for determining policy than the U.S. president.
Well, it's not just that their power, it's that I think their legacy. I mean, we Americans tend to chop up our history, our story of U.S. history, according to administrations. You know, what happened during the Truman era, what happened during the Eisenhower era, and so on. And my point in trying to resurrect the accomplishments of Alan Dulles and Curtis LeMay is to suggest that these guys, neither of them ever a president, neither one ever elected to any office whatsoever, actually had a far more lasting impact on U.S. national security policy than any president. It was Alan Dulles who really made the CIA into this powerhouse of covert operations that for a time in the 1950s seemed, it was an illusion, seemed to be an effective way to advance U.S. interests, but in fact has produced all kinds of mischief. And it was Curtis LeMay who built the United States Air Force into a massive nuclear strike force, again, for a time, seeming to hold the key to our national security, but over the long run, actually having left a series of problems that we are still trying to deal with at the present moment. So it's kind of an urge to say, or a recommendation to say, don't simply look at the presidents and what they've done in order to understand how we got here. There are these other crucially important, if in many respects largely forgotten, figures.
This is a very important part of your book. I found fascinating because someone once said, those who don't remember their past are condemned to repeat it. And as I was reading your book again, going through it, we were having the debate about the military budget in Washington with the various services competing for money, and it was a script right out of your book. And I think your book is like something that people need to read in order to understand how to read the newspapers and listening to the talking heads on television. One last thing before I wanted to talk to you about the impact and the ramifications of the use of drones, which have a very nice sleepy name, but seem to be no different than F-15s without pilots, and the fact that they're able to be manufactured as for such a low cost that countries around the world are all trying to make them and succeeding to do that. What effect do you think that is going to have? The impact is that going to have on future U.S. policy?
Well, I think it's another one of these technological developments that persuade the policymakers that this is a low-cost way to use force. Probably leads people to pay too much attention to the near term and not think about the long term. I mean, to the extent that there are only a handful of countries that can develop the kinds of drones that we're using. almost inevitably, 10 years from now or 20 years from now, there will be many, many countries that are able to build and deploy drones. Do we really want to have a world in which this basically policy of targeted assassination, disregarding sovereignty, is commonplace? Because if that's the world we live in, then we ourselves could well be subject to the consequences. It's not simply going to be a matter of us flying over somebody else's territory to kill somebody we want to kill. That could happen here in the United States. So it seems to me that people need to curb their enthusiasm a little bit and try to think through the longer-term consequences of this new weapon system.
Well, from your long experience actually in the military, as apart from sitting in a editorial boardroom or a congressional office, you actually have seen war. What would you advise people to do at this point in time, if you could give some advice to our listeners?
Well, I think as you suggested a couple of minutes ago, we need to be smarter at decoding the news, of understanding the real significance of what we're told. I mean, I think the drone thing is a good example. That it gets reported in the news as now as an almost an everyday event that there was a drone attack by the U.S. that killed some nameless person in Pakistan. But instead of simply reading that dispatch, we need to be smart enough to be able to connect it to the larger course of events in Pakistan, to understand the history of U.S.-Pakistani relations going back over several decades. We have to be able to put things in a context, and probably reading history is a good way to develop the ability to put things in a larger context.
Well, Andrew Bacevich, your latest book, Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War, is something I really appreciate you having produced, and it's something that I said in the introduction. Not only should everyone have this, but we need to get it into school children's hands so they could question the history professors who go on and on with the, they're playing a role in history teachers in maintaining this perpetual or permanent war that you so accurately and cogently describe in your book. I want to thank you very much for being our guest today on Takes on the War, and look forward to having you back again.
Thank you.
Take care.